From theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. It's been 2.5 years in the making and anticipation is reaching a fever pitch. When Derek Vincent Smith last appeared on the Unce Podcast, he told us about this enormous undertaking that had just gotten underway, in which he was conducting studio musicians to create his own breaks that he'd then record to tape, press to vinyl, then sample as if he'd found those records in a dusty back bin at a forgotten little music store in the bad part of town. 36 months, countless cross-country trips, and a crate full of vinyl later, we're on the cusp of the release of A Color Map of the Sun. Today we dig deep, deep, deep into the process behind the album, giving musicians and fans alike a true glimpse into the Pretty Lights process. Young producers, grab a pen and paper, because during this special hour-long episode of the Unce Podcast, not only do you get a master lesson in the PL procedure, but you're going to hear some of those raw breaks Derek produced into the songs you'll hear July 2nd. If you go to prettylightsmusic.com, you can pre-order the album in a variety of packages that include the double CD and double vinyl set with a bevy of those breaks, some of which you'll hear for the first time today. Today's episode is brought to you by Electric Forest Festival, taking place June 27th through the 30th at Double J Ranch in Rothbury, Michigan. Makes total sense since today's guest, Pretty Lights, is headlining this festival alongside Jam Legends, String Cheese Incident, Empire of the Sun, Above and Beyond, Beats Antique, Grismatic, Madeon, A-Track, Cruella, and more. We at theunce.com are inundated with festivals all year long, but the combination of the incredible acts, gorgeous natural setting, and that good old Midwestern vibe sets this event apart. It totally lives up to the hype, trust us. And it gets underway this week, so we're all excited. Tickets and information at electricforestfestival.com. Before we get started, I want to add a little note during this interview. Derek uses the word timbre to describe his sonic predilections. I encourage you to Wikipedia the word, T-I-M-B-R-E, because they do a pretty decent job of describing it. Essentially, it's a description of the tone color of a note. It's the reason you can differentiate between a guitar and a piano playing the same pitch, an A, a B flat, a C sharp, in the same octave at the same volume. Okay, lesson over. Let's get started. Derek, it's been 2 years since you've been on the Unce Podcast, and when we spoke last, you had just launched this enormous project that would eventually become A Color Map of the Sun. 2.5 years is a long time to be working on something, and now with 2 weeks until its July 2nd release, I wonder if you're a ball of anxiety, or if you know you're sitting on gold, and you just can't wait to get it out to the fans.
Well, you know, I know that I am sitting on a record that I am incredibly proud of and happy with, and that's what, you know, that's what's important to me. You know, like, there's been so much focus on how I made the record, the process, because it was extremely unique. But the most important part is that the music is what I envisioned and hoped would be the finished product from the beginning. And so, yeah, man, I don't know if I would let the words "I'm sitting on gold" come out of my own mouth, but I am a big fan of the record. I'm not sitting here like, oh, fuck, people aren't going to like this. You know, I think, I know that my fans are going to love the record, and I hope that it expands far beyond that, but time will tell.
Yeah, it will. And we'll obviously get back to the process in a second, but first, you made your name, well, No, you didn't just make your name. You revolutionized the industry by giving away your music for free. And you went out of your way to let fans know that they'll still be able to download the album for free on the day of its release, as always. But as a lifelong crate digger, tell me why it's important that fans consider pre-ordering that double disc vinyl edition, besides, of course, the smell of a fresh, untouched record. That's enough of a reason for me, but maybe I'm crazy.
You're not crazy, man. I would do the same thing for other artists. It's because I want people to have it in their hands, you know? It's like, it's something special. Like, I didn't only put, you know, ton of energy and effort into the music. I approached every element of this multifaceted, multimedium project with the same enthusiasm, and I'm really proud of the physical product. And that's one really big piece of it. You know, another piece of it is that because I've always opted to allow people to access my music and my discography at no charge, it's sort of created this relationship with, like, mainstream press or other artists where sometimes they sort of, like, downplay it. Like, oh, you know, he gives his music away for free because it's not real music or it's not legitimate. Like somehow it de-legitimizes it or devalues it. And I've always been so, you know, I've disagreed with that thought and that question that has come up to me before so many times passionately. You know, my whole thing with the distribution model is my philosophy on art and on creating music. And you know, I also am asking people to support this record and purchase it if they can afford it and can and want to do that, because I want people to take notice of this niche genre of electronic music that is electronic, but it's organic, you know what I'm saying? And it's dance music, mm-hmm. but it's chill out, you know, blunted music, you know what I'm saying? And it's made with synthesizers, but it's also made with samplers and organic, you know, beautiful sounding instruments. So it's an anomaly, and I want people beyond the scene that embraces it and loves it and goes to the shows. I want people beyond that to know about it and experience it, and that will only lead to every artist who's creating this kind of music getting, you know, having more people hear their music. And that's ultimately what it's about, you know, is having the music go through, get into as many ears and heads as possible and affect people emotionally and spiritually and kinetically, you know?
I don't mean to be sidetracked, but something you said is sticking with me. Even after years and years of selling out Red Rocks and topping all of these major music festivals nationwide, worldwide, are you still coming up against these gatekeepers from the old system, from these major labels or these executives who still don't understand not just what you're doing, but this sort of scene that you're spearheading? Do you still come up against that, or after this many years, are people finally coming around and understanding the absolute legitimacy of this music?
Absolutely, I'm still coming up against that all the time, and I think that it's slowly changing, and I think that this record has been the biggest milestone in my career thus far that's changed that. But man, I've run into so many things along the way where, like, you know, like this year I was billed fourth or fifth at Bonnaroo, you know, and then Rolling Stone writes an article about Bonnaroo and they put me, you know, 30th or something. They took the liberty to take me out of like the top line of billing and put me down to the bottom. Why? I've got no fucking idea. Somebody hates me over there. I don't know why, you know, like they think that they don't know. I guess that's what it is. They just don't know. And I feel like, sadly, but truly, like if it's going to take some sort of compromise between, you know, this model that I've created for my music and for PLM and the traditional sort of sound scan model where they can count, you know, how many records people, you know, how many people actually listened to my music and wanted to get it. You know what I mean? Because I can say, you know, I can check my Google Analytics and my web download stats and tell that to people as much as I want, but nobody cares because they can't verify it or they're not going to. You know, I can say, you know, we've done 20 million album downloads, and they're like, yeah, bullshit. And I'm like, no, I fucking swear. And, you know, so it's like, it's got to be, at some point, I guess, you know, in order to be legitimized by those, like, sort of, like, old boys club gatekeepers.
Right.
But that's got to happen. And it's a weird thing for me, man, because it's like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, I want to keep the bar high as it can be, and I want to push it higher, and I want to maintain standards of beauty and of music and of expression, and never let that slip. But I feel like with this record, at least, those two things can coexist. You know what I mean? Like, I made a post on Facebook that where I was encouraging people, if they could, to pre-order my record, and I said, literally, it's not about the money, and it really is not about the money, because, you know, there's no way I'm going to recoup what I put into this record. It's about getting it out there, and it's about more people being exposed to music that is substantial, you know, that you can sink your teeth into and that will affect you, you know, on multiple levels.
Grab that along with every single song in the Pretty Lights catalog for free at prettylightsmusic.com.
You hinted at this earlier. The story behind the album is that you went to Brooklyn, you went to New Orleans to work with some of the most incredible jazz, funk, and blues artists in the world, to develop your own breaks, to cut your own vinyl, and then sample your own arrangements to produce Color Map. It must have been intimidating to walk into the studios of these incredible talents without really speaking their language and to not only get them on your page, but to inspire them and pull out some raw emotional sound. Did you learn any tricks from your session with, let's call him a reticent Ralph Stanley?
Yeah. A lot of people assume that Ralph Stanley thing occurred before I began this Color Map record, when it actually took place between the Brooklyn sessions and the New Orleans sessions. So,
oh, okay.
I had actually had the chance, you know, I had learned, I had gone through this experience in Brooklyn where, you know, it was 15 days straight of working with different groups of musicians. And, yeah, to answer the beginning of your question, I was, you know, terrified at the beginning because I knew that a lot of these musicians would be expecting sheet music or wrote out arranged songs that they were supposed to play, and it wasn't like that at all. I didn't even know what I was going to do going into the studio. So, you know, I was nervous, but I did sort of formulate a plan, and with every person I worked with, you know, minus a couple people who were really on the same wavelength and got it, like Adam Deitch and Eric Krasno and Brian Coogan and Nola, like I had to communicate to each and every one of these individuals what I was doing, and each and every time there was an element of skepticism, sometimes a
sure.
little skeptical, sometimes they're like, you're fucking crazy. but I got better at communicating what I was doing, and I got better and I learned how to communicate what I wanted musically, and I got better at explaining to them what we were doing and making them understand. And there wasn't a musician or vocalist that walked out of any of these sessions thinking that sucked, or like, they loved it, you know, and it was expressed to me how different and fun it was for them to be involved in a project like this, you know. So Yeah, I did. I learned a lot, and if I hadn't done those Brooklyn sessions before the whole regeneration Ralph Stanley song, I wouldn't have been nearly as prepared as I was to tackle that project.
Well, you know, the results are, you get these incredibly talented musicians who are classically trained, who are, you know, machines when it comes to reading music and getting directions from a composer, but or a conductor rather. And then what you're doing is, you know, letting these caged animals loose and saying, play from your gut, play from your soul. Let's see what happens. You know, we don't have a net. We don't need a net. Let's hear it. And I think that with that sort of mentality, you're able to pull a really free, a really wild performance out of people. It may not always work, and I'm sure that there were some clunkers in there, but I think what you were tapping into is sort of this instinctual playing that they had all along, but maybe never had the opportunity to play in a session like that.
You know, that is what most people assume as far as how it happened when it did not happen like that at all. I was actually taking the, you know, working with these musicians who were virtuosos, like you said, and so talented, and my approach was not to say, just do your damn thing, you know, like let loose and we'll see what happens and I'll capture the best moment. You know, in fact, it was so the opposite of that, that I insisted that people, you know, that the musicians signed contracts that said that they wouldn't be writing or improvising in these sessions at all.
Wow.
And so the way that this worked was that I would write I would start with a chord, then I would develop it into a chord progression, and then I would kind of come up with a melodic line that became a melodic style, right? And then I would, in my head, imagine the timbres, because creating breaks is not extremely sophisticated music. It's simple music, but it's sophisticated in that it's very original and beautiful in its timbre and its sonic quality and the way that things come together in the minimalism of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, if I were to have let these musicians just jam out, I'd have a bunch of just nutty, you know, jam band recordings. You know what I'm saying?
It'd be disparate tones and notes and signature styles. It'd be all over the place, essentially.
Yeah, you know, there's one little story where I walked out of the studio when people, you know, a group of musicians were setting up and getting ready to go, and I came back in. I think I bought a coconut water next door at the little convenience store, and came back in, and they were all jamming, doing essentially what, you know, you said before, just letting loose and doing their thing. And I was, and to me, it was like, you know, to me, the, you know, the person who initiated these sessions and got all these people together and was paying for everything, it was painful to my ears. But I could see all these musicians having so much fun. And so I let it roll for a little while, and the engineer looks at me and he's like, "Do you want to roll tape on this?" And I was like, "Hell no." And I got the mic and I was like, All right. I've had enough of this. You know, when you guys want to go audition for, you know, some funk jam band, you guys can do that, but we're doing something different right now." And the process was, you know, to elaborate a little more on that, you know, it went from chord progression and melody in my head to timbre where, you know, it wasn't just picking the instruments that I wanted in a certain session. Well, I would pick the instruments I wanted in a session, but then per recording, I would have to imagine the sound. So let's say I had a guitar player in a session. One break, I would imagine, you know, the sound of the guitar to be an extremely over-compressed, super fuzzed out, early 70s sounding, like hard rock distortion. And then mm-hmm. I would communicate that to the engineer and say, make that sound with this guitar player, right? And I would want the Wurlitzer to be some psychedelic tape echo kind of high pass filter sound, and I would want the secondary guitar to be a tremolo affected heavy chamber reverb vintage surf rock guitar, you know, sound, and I would want the drums to have this kind of sound from this era. And a lot of times I would reference old records for certain sounds, and I would want the bass to be like a, you know, an auto-wah kind of thing. And then I would go, when I had all the timbres and the chord progression and the melodic style, then I would go to each and every musician and I would and I would tell them what I wanted them to play. And it was so often the response I got from these musicians was, "That's all you want me to do? Like, you're paying me, you're paying me to just tap a chord on the snare beat every four bars?" And I'm thinking about it like, yeah, I guess I could have hired some, you know, kid off the street to do it, but but you get it, you know, and there's a lot more potential, and you're going to do it right, and you're going to flow. So, I mean, I would ask the keyboard player, you know, like I said, to hit, you know, a G minor on the second snare every time. And then I would say, no, you know, hit it softer. Hit it on a higher octave. Wait, you know what? I think I want you to roll it with your fingers instead of just tapping it. And then I would be like, no, roll it with four fingers. Let's make it a four-finger version of this chord. And let's add the ninth on it, you know. And then I'd be like, okay, now just sustain the same chord over the whole thing on the B3, and then we'd work together for 20 minutes until he was doing exactly what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd go to the guitar player, do the same thing, and I'd be the tremolo surf rock guitar strum, and I'd say, strum this chord, and they'd strum it. And I'd be like, okay, because I'm a timbre freak and a nuance freak, like how it actually sounds, it's so important to me, not just the sonic quality, but every little minuscule element of it. So strumming a chord seems simple, right?
Sure.
But it wasn't so simple. You know, they would strum the chord and I would be like, no, strum it slower. And then I would say, actually put more pressure on each string as you strum it. Okay, no, strum it in reverse, make it an up strum. Okay, end your strum at the G string so that you don't hit it there. Okay, I want you to re-finger the same chord at a higher register so that the notes are different and come in a different order. And it was that kind of process with every melodic instrument until everybody got it. And then it would come together, and all of a sudden we have this break. And that's what the break is. It's a simplistic piece of music that is sophisticated in its timbre, in its diversity of sound and sonic qualities, and the way that every piece is playing off of each other. So as opposed to every musician playing at the same time, I would create them so rhythmically they were all kind of hitting, you know, playing their part at different times. So
there's a balance. There's an ultimate balance.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to balance it out and create something where, you know, if you just played a split second of it, you'd only hear one instrument. But mm-hmm. everything is like playing off of each other and kind of like filling in, and there would be negative space. And I really, you know, phrases that I repeated so much throughout the process is like, this is about the notes that you don't play, you know, like, this is, I want it to be minimalistic, and people would, be, you know, try to play more minimally, and I'd be like, no, way more minimally, play that that melody in literally quarter time, you know, so like, the constant struggle was to get these incredibly talented musicians to simplify their craft to the point where it was so simple, but that simple part was played so perfectly that when it all came together, it was an amazing, beautiful composition. And then when we got to that point, I'd say roll tape. We'd start playing, you know, a lot of the times I was playing either the bass, the keys, or some bizarre instrument, you know, with the rest of the musicians, and I would have a mic, and then I would conduct it, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, bass and drums out. All right, snare build back up, everybody in. Okay, guitar out. keys out. All right, we're going to break it down to just guitar and keys. And that's how I worked. And then when I felt like I had every combination that I might want or need, said like, all right, build it up, and then we're going to end it, you know, on a big one hit. And then we'd end it, let it resonate, stop tape, and move on to the next one. And that was always stressful, too, because while I was playing one break, I had to be thinking in my head, what the hell am I going to do next? You know, these guys are, you know, anticipating working this whole time, and they're getting paid, and I was, like, working and conducting and composing one piece while at the same time trying to, in the back of my head, think about what we were going to do next. So I hope that makes more sense to you, because what you initially said is what a lot of people have assumed, is that I'm a producer who samples, and I just brought in musicians and let them play whatever they wanted to and sampled it. No, that's not what happened at all, to clarify. Thank you for letting me be so worried.
No, you need to get that out there. You need to get that out there, because I don't think what people don't understand is before you even set the brush to canvas, you were meticulously standing over the palette and moving this little bit of yellow over here and mixing with spending so much time meticulously mixing the colors that you would eventually use and making sure that the colors are the exact right shade, even before you've touched the canvas.
Yeah, I was fucking building the paintbrushes, man. I was, molding the metal of the staples so I could stretch the canvas over the frame. So, yeah, no, that's a good analogy. I like that.
Break 3, one of the raw breaks Derek Vincent Smith produced during the making of A Color Map of the Sun. Pre-order the album now and get a whole CD or record of those raw samples.
I'm curious about the vocalists you used on the record. In the past, you're lifting parts of verses, choruses, maybe pitch shifting them or chopping them up beyond recognition for your own uses. In spending time with these people, crafting the lyrics, pulling these raw performances out of singers and rappers, did you find it more difficult to slice and dice and modulate their parts? Or is that really when the magic happens for you?
Yeah, all of that. I tried to do as much research and find out as much as I could about the singers that I could possibly work with before I invited them in to the studio, to make sure that their voice had the sonic quality that I really was striving for. And mm-hmm. then when we got in the studio, you know, the same thing with the breaks. I was writing lyrics on the fly and thinking about the lyrics for the next the next recording while I was, you know, working on one of them. And yeah, it was difficult, but one thing that I did with the vocalist to, in an attempt to emulate the sample collage hip hop production approach to making music, was I wanted to make it more difficult for myself to work with the vocalist. Because, you know, in the past, when I would dig through record stores and record collections and find vocal snippets, you know, it's not like they were ever in the key or the tempo of the song that I was working on. I mean, once in a rare occasion that would happen. But, and so because of that, by the time I worked with the vocalist, I had a lot of the songs in the works. And so I would write some lyrics for a certain song, and then I would purposefully have the singer sing those lyrics over a different song or a different break, or, you know, a different recording in a different key and a different tempo, so that later when I was using it, I was actually, you know, sampling it and producing it how I would have if I found it on some, you know, old soul record. Because magic happens in this world of hip hop production, electronic hip hop production, you know, and sampling combined into that, especially when you take multiple elements that were never intended to go together, and then through the tools at your disposal as a producer, making them work together and either stretching them, tuning them, affecting them, chopping them, making them work in a way that it sounds like they were supposed to be that way. That's the challenge. That's always been the challenge with sample collage production, was making things that weren't intended to go together sound like they were intended to go together. And that's when really special things happen, you know. And I purposely tried to recreate that process from the beginning with my thinking, so I knew that I wouldn't just, you know, pull up this piece of, you know, this acetate cut record of vocal recordings, and they would perfectly fit on some track that I was working on. That was never the case. I purposefully would have singers sing in a different key, in a different tempo, so that I would have to force myself to be more creative with that. I think that was part of what you were asking me.
That's wild. I would have never guessed that would have been the process. But you know what you're doing, and the Pretty Lights process works, so why would you fuck with that by making it easy on yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to make it, I mean, think about it. I mean, I decided that I wanted to use only super old gear and super old shit, and only onto stereo tape, like, and then press it to vinyl. You know, if I'm going to go through this whole process of making wax because I'm trying to retain the sound, the sonic quality of my production style, then I'm beyond just creating wax, I'm going to do everything I can to emulate the other aspects of hip hop production, which is not just digging through records. Once you find the samples on the records, making them fit and making them work together and making them sound beautiful together. And so I didn't, and there's something special about that. You know, if a singer sings a melody on a song that the vocals will end up on, they think about it in a certain way, but they're going to sing a totally different melody on a different track. And if you take that melody and put it on a different track, they never would have sang that melody if I would have had them sing over that track in the first place, if that makes any sense.
It does.
Yeah.
Have you created a Fort Knox of vinyl for yourself now? Are you going to be able to, you know, churn out a couple more albums after this one using this material, or are you now addicted to this new process of going right to the source and making new samples and creating this catalog of vinyl for yourself to pick through and make work?
Both of those. I mean, by no means did I wouldn't say I didn't scratch the surface. I definitely used a lot of what I created, but there's also very much more beautiful samples and recordings sitting in this crate of one-of-a-kind acetates that I have, you know, that I can definitely produce a lot more music from. But at the same time, I have become extremely intrigued and I guess addicted, like you said, to this idea and this process and the idea of evolving it even further, you know, because like I said earlier, when I first stepped into it, I was terrified, but by the end of it, I was extremely confident in my ability to communicate to the people I was working with and to be able to direct them to get the performances that I heard in my head. So yeah, I see myself producing with the records I've already created, and I see myself creating more, and I see myself also going back to what I did before, man, because that's how it all started, and I'm not gonna stop digging for records. I mean, that's one of the most fun things in the world for me is to hang out in a dusty record shop for hours and just look through vinyl and listen to 45s and old forgotten LPs. I mean, I just love that, you know. So there will definitely be more sample-based music from myself as a producer. Sample-based in the sense that I did not create the samples.
Mm-hmm.
Just because that's so much fun. It's just fun, you know, and Pretty Lights is in my mind a morphing, evolving project and vision. It's not one thing, you know. It's not just me as a producer in my mind. It's a live band. It's a fucking futuristic orchestra, you know. Maybe that won't happen for 10 years, who knows? But it's anything and everything that I can imagine it to be and manifest into reality.
Thank you.
Pretty Lights, You Get High. Before that, Reel 7 Break 1, one of the raw breaks Derek Vincent Smith produced during the making of A Color Map of the Sun, which you can pre-order now at prettylightsmusic.com.
A few throwback Thursdays ago, you posted a picture of the Freeze, you and Mike Menard and Paul Brandt. You're putting together a live band for the fall tour. When was the last time you were out on the road with a full band? Stinky Dudes in a Van? What does that play into your process for selecting artists for the act, or are you just looking for the best musicians, bar none?
I am so glad you asked that. I was just having a conversation with Adam Foley, who's one of my managers, and I was like, man, I think I just want to go back to playing like 500-person bars and like travel around in a van that barely works with like a trailer. I was like, I kind of miss that.
McChicken wrappers all up on the dashboard.
Yeah,
just,
you know,
that funk in the car, just the funkiest smell.
Yeah, man. And I have been there, trust me. I was there for a long time, and there were lots of calls to you know, relatives. I say relatives because the parents got crossed off the list quick as far as trying to come up with funds to fix the radiator, you know, in Flagstaff, Arizona. Or I remember post Freeze, the band you mentioned, I was in a band called Listen with Michael Menard and Corey Eberhart and a DJ named Ken Daly. And our band was called Listen, and we were on our way to Joshua Tree Music Festival. We had a gig there. It must have been 110 degrees outside, and the radiator was overheating, and I was driving the busted-ass van that we called the Roach. That was the name of the car. The Roach. I think the carpet was littered with roaches, and plus it just, you know, had that quality to it.
Had that vibe.
Inside and out. But yeah, I remember we were going to be late. We were going to miss our gig. The van, like, was overheating. I pulled into a parking lot. I got under the van in this ridiculous weather, and I realized that there was some mysterious tube leaking. And I was like, somebody give me a piece of gum. And I started to chew gum under the van, and then I sealed this hole up and started like blowing a bubble. And I ran into the truck stop or whatever it was and found some things and taught myself how to patch a hose under the van. And I actually fucking fixed the van, and we made it to the gig. And, then when we got to the gig, all the sand in the park, I think, broke all of our MPCs, and we had to just, like, freestyle it without any of our electronics, which was cool.
But you played your asses off, and you know, you were on the road, you were kids in this van, and there was this energy that, you know, it's hard to recapture. I mean, that was being in a band on the road, and there's just... there's an energy about it. There's a vibe, and there's something that you can't really replace that with anything.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and when I was at Bonnaroo last weekend, I got to play bass up on stage during the hip hop super jam, and I hadn't been on stage playing bass as part of a full band in quite some time, and it was just a great time, man. I just loved it. I loved just focusing on this one instrument, and letting all the other musicians worry about their part, and like and it definitely had an effect on how I'm thinking about putting together a live band, and it's already well in the works, but what's most important to me about assembling this is that, you know, I'm not just going to pay, you know, session musicians to come on the road with me, man. It's about keeping it crew and like playing with homies. And so, you know, I'm going to have talented musicians that are also my friends, and so that we can have fun and communicate and have spontaneous moments of musical enlightenment, you know, during sound check. And I plan to have full capabilities of recording the live band during sound check or during the show or whatnot. And, you know, one thing I want to say is that when I was thinking about this before I had really dedicated myself to doing it, it was like, I know that producers or DJs or even, you know, MCs who their entire records are produced beats will bring bands out on the road. And it's either the band trying to recreate the production or the band playing on top of the production, which is the case with every, you know, producer who plays with the drummer or plays a instrument behind their, you know, laptop. It's, you know, it's playing on top of these beats that they've produced. And so it was really important to me to come up with a method and an approach completely original and new as far as how the production and the, you know, what a Pretty Light show has come to be right now, the live band element. And I think I'm pretty damn confident that the idea and the approach that I have is going to be a very new experience of that whole live band and produced music coming together in a performance environment. And I'm constantly thinking about how to evolve that idea, and I'm really looking forward to getting into the rehearsals and working with the people that I've assembled for this band. And I really just can't wait to get in the same room and then eventually get on stage and to really weave a tight knit connection between all of us and really create some special shows, you know, that people remember forever and really enjoy in the moment.
Well, as excited as you are, I can tell you your fans are over the moon with the announcement, and they're on the edge of their seats waiting for July 2nd for the album. Derek Vincent Smith, Pretty Lights, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about the new album and the new stage show and tell us about The Roach, and it's been a joy.
Man, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and it's been too long. It doesn't feel like it's been 2 years since we spoke, but yeah. Well, let's do it again sooner, because it's just nice for me to be able to chat about this kind of stuff. It's not an interview. It's not a typical sort of like that I do, you know, a lot. It's really an opportunity for me to get in deep about what I want to talk about and what you want to know about and what the people who love the Unts want to know about Yeah, man. I'm a big fan of the site, and I'm a big fan of everything that you and your team does. So I appreciate getting to talk to you about my new album. So thank you.
That's going to do it for today's episode. Special thanks go to the entire Pretty Lights team. Everybody at Red Light, Justin Kleinfeld with Reflector Inc., and Crystal Blackburn with Pretty Lights Music. You get to enjoy all this great music and get down at all the live shows, but it's a big crew that makes it all happen, so we want to make sure they get the thanks they deserve. And of course, special thanks go to Derek Vincent Smith. A Color Map of the Sun comes out July 2nd, and you can pre-order the album now at prettylightsmusic.com. Today's episode was sponsored by Electric Forest. Join the Unts in Rothbury, Michigan, June 27th through the 30th for the annual celebration of incredible music, mind-blowing installations, and some of the best people on the planet. Headliners include String Cheese Incident, Knife Party, Benny Benassi, Lotus, Yodo, Bauer, and of course today's guest, Pretty Lights. This is the event people talk about all year. It's just a special place, and we hope to see you out there. Tickets and information at electricforestfestival.com. Hit up our contest page at theunts.com/contests to win yourself free passes to Lightning in a Bottle, Global Dance Festival, Arise Festival, PAX, Mad Decent Block Party, and so many more. It's free to sign up, and once you do, you can enter as many contests as you like with one click of a button. We'll also keep you up to date on all the events in your area specifically tailored to your interests. Please visit theunts.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the Unts podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunts.com. That's A-N-A-N-D at theunts.com. Join the conversation at the Unts podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week. Take a minute while I pull another people in as I get chance to make a first impression of them. To the break of the part and the seas with a big sound, make round shakedowns, and I take a motherfucker out east, A-slide. Anytime I'm ready, gonna sit in the midst of slicing and dicing that bright light energy, infinitive, and quite like energy.